Salem Yuma advises Flight Director Pete Frank. The hatch is probably coming open now.
Okay, Houston, we've got a jettison now.
Roger. Interior is Houston. Okay, I hadn't heard from you in a while, Ed. Just wondering how things gone.
Well, we're pressing along here, Fred. We're pretty well along in our stowage. And if you look at the service checklist, we're at the top of the second column at page 75.
Okay, very good, Al.
And we'll have a weight report of the location of all the stowage for you here momentarily.
Okay.
And then we'll probably eat, and then we'll probably rest for a while.
Sounds good.
It's Apollo Control, Houston. A ground elapsed time of 137 hours, 58 minutes. That was Fred Hayes speaking both with Ed Mitchell and Al Shepard. Our displays presently show a preliminary time for the liftoff of Antares. This at a ground elapsed time of 142 hours, 25 minutes, 39 seconds. With a delta V of 6,067.4 feet per second. This is planned to place Antares in an orbit of 52.2 nautical miles apolune, 9.2 nautical miles perilune. We're at 137 hours, 59 minutes, and this is Apollo Control, Houston.
Okay, just wondered, are both of you still tied up with the stowage aside from the debriefing? We do have a little bit of a steerable comm check we need to get out of the way, and if you are free, Ed, maybe we could tackle that now.
Okay, Fred, we're ready to go with you here in just 1 second. If you have pads or anything, you can work with me on before the debriefing. I'm ready to start.
Okay, I'll turn it over here to Joe, and he can read you up this little test they want to do in a steerable.
Hello, Houston Antares. Joe, you read?
You bet, Ed. We're just getting switched around on the comm down here, and what we want to do, Ed, is to verify this acquisition and tracking capability. First thing we'd like to do is to go to the track mode switch to the SLU position and slowly rotate the pitch knob over the entire range and verify corresponding travel on the meters and also listen to the antenna driving if you can. After you've done that, we'll do the same thing with the yaw knob. So first of all, go track mode to SLU and rotate the pitch knob and see if you get corresponding travel and see if you can hear it rotate.
That's Joe Engel, the backup lunar module pilot, speaking to Ed Mitchell aboard Antares. We're at 138 hours, 43 minutes, ground elapsed time. This is Apollo Control, Houston.
Roger, Ed, go ahead.
Okay, I'm watching the antenna out the window, the shadow of it anyhow, and the needles, and it does drive over the entire range in both pitch and yaw. There's a great deal of lightly damped oscillation. It takes quite a while to stabilize after you pick a particular setting of the thumb wheels, but it eventually gets there.
Okay, very good, Ed. Let's check the acquisition now. If you'll set the pitch to plus 120 and yaw to minus 38, and you're in slew position, and verify that you get a signal strength greater than 3.
Okay, Joe, I've got a signal strength of
3.8, okay, very good. Now go to auto and see if the signal strength comes up any. And also notice, if you will, if the pitch and yaw meters move any from your present position.
Okay, the signal strength stayed the same. And I'm indicating on the needles 130 and minus 40.
Okay, I understand. 130, 130, and minus 40.
Yep.
Okay, and now stand by.
It's flight, Joe, if you'll remember it. Let me say that in flight, there were a couple of times it locked on beautifully. However, in order to get it to lock on, I had to get the main lobe up. It would not lock on with just having signal strength up around 3.2 or 3.4. I had to have signal strength up around 3.8 before I went to auto. Or if I went to auto with less than that, it just drove off and went to the stops. Several times, however, it locked up and was tracking very nicely, and then proceeded a few seconds later or a few minutes later to pop a antenna circuit breaker. So I think that it's overheating somewhere, and either that or some problem in the electronics that's causing it to pop circuit breakers.
Yeah, okay, that sounds like a pretty good analysis, Ed. And stand by just a second. We'll have a couple more little things to try here before we terminate this. Okay, Ed, now what we'd like to do is to, let me read this through before you do each step, but go back to the slew position and set the pitch and yaw angles the same as what you're reading now on auto track at 130 and minus 40. And let's see, make sure we're in that position.
Okay, going to slew and selecting the thumb wheel position to match the needles.
Apollo Control, Houston. Now, what you're hearing is a communications checkout.
It's pretty close that time.
Okay, very good. Now, what we want you to do is to, while you're in slew position, drive the pitch control off, rotate the pitch control 8 degrees clockwise, and then go back track mode to auto and see if it will reacquire.
A
degrees clockwise.
A communications checkout involving S-band steerable antenna on Antares. This is Joe Engel in Mission Control speaking from the Capcom console. Ed Mitchell aboard Antares responding. We're at 138 hours 49 minutes ground elapsed time. This is a
come back at 8 degrees, Joe.
Okay, beautiful. Okay, let's go back to SLU and set the angles up again at 130 and minus 40, and we'll do the same thing with the yaw control. We'll rotate it 8 degrees clockwise and then back to auto and see if it'll track back.
Okay. Yeah, I see him come back in, Joe.
Okay, that's about all we can check, I guess, Ed. Let me give you a configuration that we'd like to go to in the event that we do have tracking problems during ascent, because we would like to maintain high bit rate if possible. Let me know when you have a pencil out and a card that you can copy it on. Maybe the AGS, your AGS card there would be a good place to have it. And for your information...
Okay, Joe, I'm ready.
Okay, very good. I was just going to say, there's only five items here, so it won't be very much. We'd like... In the event you do lose steerable now, we'll go down voice backup, biomed left, audio mode to ICS push to talk, and to high bit rate. And of course then we'll want aft omni during the ascent.
Okay, I've got four of them, Joe. The next to the last one, I guess I don't have. Down voice backup, biomed left, high bit rate, and what's the next to the last one, and then aft omni.
Okay, audio mode to ICS push to talk, Ed.
Okay, ICS PTT.
Okay, very good. And that configuration is only in the event we lose tracking with the steerable.
Okay. Will do, Joe.
Okay, thank you, Ed, and I'll give you back to Fredo here. Stand by just a minute.
Houston, we're standing by with the debriefing questions here whenever y'all are both ready to go.
Yeah, we're ready to go right now, Fredo.
Okay. Okay, the first question is to describe texture or fracture patterns or any surface characteristics of the large boulders or in the boulder field you were describing at Cone Crater.
You want textures and patterns of the boulders themselves?
That's affirmative, Mel.
Well, we made some remarks, as I recall, coming back down about the fact that they looked weather-beaten, the fact that they maybe were fairly soft rocks, because they looked very much like rocks that had been weather-beaten through the atmosphere. I think that was one of the types of textures that we noted. We noted other rocks that were very fine-grained, crystalline rocks, and essentially very smooth on the outside. We have a sample of one of those, football size. These are really the only two textures that I noticed. Did you notice any addition to that?
Well, no, I can't say that I did specifically. It wasn't really a matter of being able to describe what we saw in this particular case, because at that point we were so rushed that all we were trying to do was see different things and grab it without really noting how it necessarily differed. The only thing that I recall about these craters, around these boulders, was that they were there were inclusions or variations within the rock, and I assumed that they were crystals within the rock, right? There was a crystalline form within the rock. I don't know that that's true. They might have been, for example, a breccia with stuff just a conglomerate in them, and I don't know whether that's true or not either. There simply wasn't time to look at them in that detail, so we just grabbed, photographed, and ran. And I'd be kind of at loss to give you an articulate description of really what those rocks are like.
I just think we have good samples of the two types that we saw on the west rim of the crater. Ed got a small piece of a light-colored rocks, and we actually brought back one that was typical of the other reddish-brown rocks.
Okay, yeah, very good.
I should say, okay.
Okay, the second question was, I guess, one that was asked somewhere along the way, and did you ever notice there being dust on tops of any of the boulders around Cone?
Let me make a stab at that, Fredo. I noticed some of the rocks, the smaller boulders that were closer to the ground, were covered with dust. But I recall boulders that were not covered with dust. And for example, the boulders out here closer to the limb, the last boulder field I went to, did not have any appreciable dust on those rocks. And the white ones that I sampled up near Cone Crater did not have any appreciable dust on them. However, others did. As a matter of fact, there was one of the boulders in that group of the white boulders that I photographed for you, but it was too big to do anything with. It had brown and white, and I couldn't tell what kind of a contact it was, whether the white part was because it had been broken away or whether it was a contact of two different materials. It was just, there just wasn't time to investigate that sort of phenomena, so we tried to simply sample the two types and photograph it. But as far as dust is concerned, I think we've seen both, and among the larger boulders, there are certainly a large number that do not have any dust on them.
Okay.
Yeah, that's generally true. I think we probably would have been aware of dust. I think that's generally true, that we probably would have been aware of dust. There certainly was a lot of filleting, and we tried to document that for you, but I would say, generally speaking, there was no dust on any of the on the surface of any of the rocks that we saw.
Roger. And the next question, when you were high on the slopes there of Cone, could you tell any differences in the surface color tone when you looked back in the area to the south and to southwest?
Well, of course, the obvious differences in the bright craters, those are always noticeable, and those were there. Beyond that, I wasn't aware of any marked contrast in color tones.
Well, I don't know whether it's a figment of my imagination or not. I always noted going up there this morning, or thought I noted, that the area around Old Nameless was, there were some darker patches, but we were so preoccupied with finding our way to the top of Cone Crater that I neither observed it or made remarks about that observation, nor really observed it that much more closely.
Roger, Ed. Hopefully, maybe the pans will pick that up. Okay, next question on, this is for Ed. When you attempted the second triple core, and I think you really answered this in real time, but just to get it straight, did you think you hit another rock, like you mentioned bedrock on the first attempt, or did it just get progressively harder to drive?
Well, I was wasn't quite sure, but I thought that I'd hit rock again. But when I pulled it out, it could very well have been just a compaction type of phenomenon where it just quit driving. And I don't know the answer. It felt like in driving it that I'd hit something pretty solid, but it wasn't as though I'd hit a very sharp line of rock as opposed to soft material. It went down fairly well, and then it tightened up, and then it just stopped.
Okay, and to back up a little further back in time, we missed when the double core was task was done. About how far could you push the tube down before you started hammering? Okay. And this one is for for Al. About how deep were you down in with the trench, Al, when the side walls started caving in?
Well, actually, the first cut I took was down to about 6 inches, and there was some caving at that time. The side walls were then at probably about 70 to 80 degrees. The next cut I took made the walls a little more steep, closer to the vertical, perhaps 80, 85. And at that point, they started coming down. Fine grain regolith at the top of the cut just tumbled down into the trench.
Okay, and I guess I ask you in real time the thickness of the intermediate layer, but they'd also like to know if you have any estimate on the thickness of the very top layer.
Well, I sure don't. It wasn't, they say, stratigraphy in the classic sense, because it all started to crumble after the first couple of strokes. That was a place where you had took a sample of some light-colored material. It was fairly close to the surface.
The upper layer that you're talking about, the brown, and the next one in the white, the brown seemed to be showing the white in some places after an inch or 2 inches. I'm not sure it was another layer, but it had to be. I can't find another explanation for it, but it seemed to be very thin, 1 or 2 inches in the top layer.
I think that's probably a pretty good call. I'd say maybe 2 inches. And of course we had that thin layer of fairly glassy material, which I collected. And then the bottom whiter material, which Ed got a sample of, as well as the ones I took.
Okay, and you've already answered the next part of this question, which was distinction between layers. You had both color and textural distinctions there that told you had the layering. And I guess the last part maybe you've answered too, but it's questioning whether the wall caving, you think maybe it was a natural event, or do you think it was due to dragging the trenching tool through the cut?
Well, I'm not sure. I had an unnatural shovel. And I'm not quite sure what the question is now that I think back about it again, but you mean that...
I thought you answered that, Al, because you... Your previous comment indicated that it started caving in with your first stroke, and if that was true, then it looks like the trenching tool helped bring the walls down.
Well, I'm sure that it did. And actually, it was in about the second stroke where it started to occur, because the first drag through was the walls were less steep. But I'm sure the tool had a lot to do with it.
Okay, the next question, when we were sort of quickly passing by North Triplet Crater on the way back to Antares, you mentioned in passing there coming upon a little boulder field. And the question is, do you think this boulder field was tied in some way to North Triplet, possibly part of a ray?
I recall that we inferred they were boulders. I think that we thought they were a field of ejected material from that particular crater. And therefore, we took some samples there. Is that the spot you're referring to?
Yeah, that's it, Al.
Yeah, if we inferred they were bolas, that was incorrect. They were just hand samples and perhaps up to 8 to 10 inches, but all up together as though they'd been ejected from that crater and right on our path. And we took a couple samples from that area.
As a matter of fact, there were boulders, which we also thought came out of probably the same area, but there wasn't anything around the boulders that seemed small enough and obvious enough to grab in the on the run like we tried to do with this bunch of samples.
Okay. The next question is, did you see any evidence of downslope creep with respect to the cone crater fillets you saw on the uphill side of rocks?
Yeah, I did, and I'm not so sure, but what part of the delineation that I was talking about would not be found on cone in a circular around the crater. Now, I saw these same things up there, and I described them before, so I didn't say anything about it again. But my guess is that they go circular around Cone Crater. Now, that may be entirely wrong.
You mean sort of like contour lines, Ed?
Except probably for direction. That's what I'm suggesting, but it's merely a suggestion, and I didn't follow them out, and I didn't check them that closely to be able to prove it. But where I did see them, they were indeed kind of parallel to the slope. I mean, parallel to the rim of the crater. In other words, around the crater.
Very good, Ed. Next question. The difficulty you had at the last there climbing up to Cone Rim, was that due primarily to the terrain slope, or did the soil conditions change again that may cause you to have some greater problems?
I think probably both. I think we just entirely underestimated the difficulty of going that far and getting that high in such a short period of time. It's a darn hard climb to try to do rapidly, and the soil's a little bit thin and mushy, and the suits are bulky. It's all those problems rolled in, Fred. It was too ambitious, I guess.
Let me say that I don't really think that the composition of the soil changed very much. As a matter of fact, that was one thing that struck me about the whole area: the consistency of the texture of the regolith outside of the soft areas, of course, in crater rim. I think as far as the progress up there is concerned, it was due to the grade and the boulders and the rocks that we had to go around. But really, as far as the surface texture is concerned, as far as the bearing strength of the surface, I thought outside of the crater rims that it was unusually consistent all the way through. And the thing that surprised me was the pattern of the raindrop pattern with these very small surface pebbles, which is entirely different than we have down here in this area where we've landed.
Yeah, I think we remarked on the similarity of the surface. I think I remarked at one spot that it seemed to be getting a little harder up there, but that seemed to have been isolated. It wasn't true in general. It seems to be in that one local area. And certainly, as Al pointed out, the softest areas, by and large, are crater rims, fairly fresh crater rims. And when you run it through one of those, you get some fairly soft material. But otherwise, it's about like you saw here near the limb on television, the way we were pressing into that.
Roger. The next question is, how abundant and what was the distribution of glass that you saw around on the surface, or I guess in one case you mentioned it draped on a rock.
Yeah, we went roaring past one rock that had some, well, what looked like glass splatter. I'm pretty sure that it was. And I'm sure there are other samples of that out here, but we did not see them. The that was really the only example of glass that that I could positively identify, or come close to positively identify as being glass per se. There are some crystalline rocks out here, and I'm sure we got some samples of them for you.
Yeah, I concur with that. I was surprised that we didn't obviously see more glass. A lot of the smaller rocks that we did pick up that were sample size were so darn dirty that they may have glass in them. But they're just covered with this dirt, which...